nanohub.org.
You can follow along with this presentation using printed slides from the NanoHub. Visit www.nanohub.org and download the PDF file containing the slides for this presentation. Print them out and turn each page when you hear the following sound. Enjoy the show.
We have with us today Dr. McCann, director of C3 Bio, and I know her as the director of the Purdue Energy Center at Discovery Park, which is kind of our the entity that helps the Purdue Energy Club out a lot with everything we do on campus. So we're really excited to have her here talking to you today about C3 Bio and biofuels in general. So without further ado, let's hear Dr. McCann.
So thank you, and thanks for the invitation to come and speak to you guys. And I've been meaning to drop in on some of your Energy Club events for a while now. I want to start here with the view from the Department of Energy about the energy inputs and supply in the U.S. And if you look at the left-hand side of the diagram, you'll see that we're highly dependent on fossil fuels. So 40% roughly of all energy input is oil. And another 22.5% comes from coal. And that's mainly coal-fired electricity, of course. And then another large slice, 22.5% from natural gas. And the renewables, what we think of as the sustainable, renewable alternative energy forms are much lower percentages. So geothermal at 0.33, wind is barely detectable on here, hydro a little more, solar is a minor component, and biofuels at about 3%. And if you look over the right-hand side of the diagram, you'll see some other interesting numbers, and that is that the useful energy output from all of these inputs, from all of these sources of energy, is actually only 42.5%. So in converting energy from one form to another and transmitting it to devices and our cars and so forth, we actually lose more than half of the energy. So this isn't anything to do with conservation. This isn't putting in compact fluorescent light bulbs instead of ordinary light bulbs. This is simply energy loss in terms of what we start out with. Okay? So one of the things that the Office of Science in the Department of Energy is interested in doing is shifting us away from this dependence on oil and coal because of the effects of burning these fossil fuels and adding carbon to the atmosphere. They want to shift us more in the direction of a diversified portfolio of energy sources. So much more into solar, into wind, maybe some into nuclear, into biofuels, geothermal, and natural gas is actually fine too. So if you're going to have these big shifts from the traditional supply sources that we have, you can't really do it with incremental changes. You can't make a small advance in science and engineering and change the way that this picture looks. So what they recognized was that We needed a new way of doing science and engineering. We needed to think about the energy problem in terms of really changing some paradigms here, really making some game-changing advances in a lot of different areas. So they funded 46 Energy Frontier Research Centers that actually span the whole gamut of the energy sciences. So some of them work on hydrogen, some of them work on solar. We work on biofuels. So we were given $20 million for a 5-year project in the biofuels area. And This is DOE's words, so this is their expectation for us, that we'll harness the most basic and advanced discovery research for a concerted effort to establish a scientific foundation for a fundamentally new U.S. energy economy. So there's no pressure, right? We don't have to deliver. I mean, there's no worries here. So I want to tell you about our center today. We're the Center for Direct Catalytic Conversion of Biomass to Biofuels. And we abbreviate that to C3Bio. And what I'm going to do is explain to you some of the kind of background and rationale for where the biofuels industry sits today and what we are hoping to do that will kind of change that playing field. So biofuels are a mature industry in the economy. We can take grains, we can take corn, that's the little kernels that are on the corn cobs, and we can take the starch in those grains of corn, break them down with enzymes so that they release glucose from the starch, and then that glucose becomes a carbon source for microorganisms. And those microorganisms can take that carbon in as glucose and then convert it into ethanol. And we're used to doing this from yeasts that make wine and beer. So potato starch, you can do this with. You can take the sugar from sugar cane or sugar beet and give it to a living organism and allow it to ferment that. You can take oils from plant seeds and you can transesterify them and turn them into biodiesels. So these are existing industries. This is what the ethanol industry works on, is the corn kernels and the conversion of starch and then the fermentation to ethanol. But if you think about those corn grains, those corn kernels, and if you think about seeds in a plant, it's a very small proportion of the plant. It's a tiny amount, proportionally, of plant biomass. And so what we'd really like to do is to use some of the sugars that are actually used to build the body of the plant. So this is what I'm going to call lignocellulosic biomass. And what we need to do is we need to be able to get that lignocellulosic biomass in a form that will actually go into car engines. And we want to do it cheaply. We want to do it for maybe 70 cents, a dollar a gallon. So I'm going to tell you a little bit about what biomass is at a molecular level. If I take a slice through the stalk of a plant, then I can see all these kinds of cells, all these cells of different sizes and shapes that make up the body of the plant. And every single one of those cells lives inside a box. And the walls of that box are built of cellulose and other polysaccharides. So if I zoom in now on that brown area and just magnify up one tiny region of one of those cells, then I can see the architecture of the cell wall that the plant cell lives within. And you can see in this image, this is a transmission electron micrograph, these very thick, long cables that cross the whole dimension of the image here. Those are the cellulose microfibrils. Those are the main scaffolding poles that the cell wall is organized around. And then there are other polysaccharides that sort of interlink them and make a network. Because one thing you'll notice when you look at this is that it's got a structure. It's not cement. It's not jelly. It's actually got a very defined architecture of its own. You can see that there are holes in this structure that other molecules are going to be able to move through. So if we look in a different part of the stalk now, so not these cells that were down in the center of the stalk, but the ones inside that brown box, then these cells are specialized to conduct water within the plant. They're a cell type called xylem. And this is a xylem cell seen magnified end on. And what it does is it forms this hollow tube through the plant so that you pull water in at the roots and the water can flow right through these xylem cells and reach all of the leaves and the flowers and so forth. So the reason I'm showing you this image is that the walls of this cell type have got another compound impregnated all in and around that cellulose and polysaccharide structure that I showed you in the first picture. And that molecule, that huge macromolecule actually, is called lignin. And the reason lignin is here in this cell is that it waterproofs it. So it waterproofs the walls of the cell so that you make this pipe, so that you make part of the plant's plumbing. The fact that the lignin fills up all those holes in that architecture becomes a real problem for us when we want to take this material apart and convert it into usable forms of carbon. So these lignified walls, they're not every cell in the plant, but they're the most resistant cell type. So as the plant sits in the field and it dries and it becomes desiccated and we might want to harvest it later, these are the walls that survive the longest. So this is how DOE was thinking about how to use lignocellulosic biomass to make fuel. So you start off with a variety of plant species. It could be fast-growing trees like willow or poplar. Eucalyptus is another option. It could be grass species, and the grasses include the maize plants that you see growing 6 feet high in the fields around here. It includes switchgrass, miscanthus, crops that we think will be dedicated bioenergy feedstocks. So you take that biomass and cut it into pieces, shred it, and then use enzymes, use biological catalysts to break down those cellulose cables into glucose. So cellulose is a polymer of glucose, just as starch is a polymer of glucose. So you use an enzyme to break that down into simple sugars, and then take those sugars. So instead of the sugars coming from starch, now they're coming from the entire plant body. Feed those to your microorganism that will ferment them to ethanol, or in some cases to other types of fuel. So there are researchers that are looking at how you could make butanol with this strategy. And then also a company called LS9 in California that's interested in making alkanes. So engineering the microorganism to synthesize alkanes, alkanes being the major component of gasoline. So this was the starting point for when we started to think what we would do in C3 Bio, because there's a few problems, there's a few issues with thinking of making biofuels by this strategy. So the first problem is you don't do anything with the lignin. The lignin is 1/3 of the mass of the biomass. So the carbon that has been trapped so carefully by the plant, you know, it's filtered 385 parts per million CO2 out of the atmosphere, tremendous sensitivity for this carbon dioxide, and it's locked up that carbon in a solid form now. And now we're going to say, okay, there's no use for 1/3 of this carbon that is in the lignin structure. Maybe we'll burn it. Maybe we'll get some heat from it for co-firing. But We won't use it directly. We won't take that carbon and get it into a fuel molecule. The other problem with this is that because of the presence of the lignin, the biological catalyst, the enzymes, can't access that cellulose and the polysaccharides very easily because the lignin's plastered all over it, filling up all the holes. The enzymes just can't reach it. So you don't recover all of the sugars that you should recover from the 2/3 of the biomass that's actually cellulose and useful polysaccharide. And then the third issue with this is the problem of using a living organism. So anytime you've got a microorganism that's carrying out a fermentation, it's using some of the carbon that you supply to it in its own growth. So those cells are dividing, they're expanding, they're dividing again. A lot of glucose is being used just to keep these microbes alive. And they're breathing. So they're throwing out some of that carbon that the plant had trapped as CO2, right, back into the atmosphere. So we calculated that at best, if this worked perfectly and you could recover all of the sugar that you could recover, you would only use, say, about 30 to 40% of the carbon that was in the biomass that you started with into a final biofuel product, right? So in a unit of biomass, any unit you like, whether it's a single plant or you think about a kilogram or you think about a ton of biomass, only about 1/3 of that biomass is ending up as fuel. And that wouldn't be an issue if you could grow an unlimited supply of biomass, right? So if we could turn the whole of the U.S. into a giant farm and supply all the biomass that was needed, maybe we would be okay. But this is a huge but. A biorefinery that depends on fermentation, that is built to scale, costs about $400 million. So you've got a huge capital investment to build this biorefinery. And then each of these circles that surround the biorefinery in the center are radii of 25, 50, and then 75 miles. Once you're at a radius of 50 miles outside the biorefinery doors, you're using more energy to transport the biomass to the biorefinery than you'll recover in the fuel that you make. So there's a couple of issues here. The first is that we really need to grow biomass with much higher efficiency on the land that we have available. And the second thing is we want to improve the carbon efficiency of how much fuel we can recover for each unit of biomass. That's the only way we're actually going to make the biofuels scenario work. So this slide is just to say that we can do something about the amount of biomass that is grown on an acre of land. We haven't done it yet because 5 decades, 6 decades of crop improvement, for example, for maize, has all been with the goal of improving the yield of grain, so the yield of corn. And we've made fantastic progress because maize plants used to grow with their leaves pointing down. Now we have varieties that grow with these leaves pointing up, and they're fantastic solar collectors because of this orientation, and they channel all that sunlight into the grain production. But there are naturally occurring maize varieties that grow 15 feet tall, not the 6 feet where we grow a maize plant for grain. But if we were growing this for biomass, you know, we would harvest these materials at 15 to 20 feet. This guy is not a pygmy, by the way. He is a normal-sized guy on a stepladder to tassel these maize plants. So we haven't done this, but the USDA is actually working now towards giving out money for researchers to improve the yield of biomass crops. We need to double it. We need to triple it. We need to keep extending how much we can grow per acre. That's not what we're doing in C3 Bio. What we're really concerned with in C3 Bio is how we can improve that carbon efficiency. Because if we can double the carbon efficiency from 30 to 40% to 60 to 80%, we'll halve the amount of land that you need to grow the biomass on. So we would have a huge impact on land use. So our goal are these advanced biofuels with maximized carbon and energy efficiencies. We don't think ethanol is the answer. We would like to go straight for something that looks like a gasoline equivalent. And we would like to also make some other highly valuable molecules along the way. We're mostly centered at Purdue. So $15 million of the $20 million stays here at Purdue amongst 15 different researchers. And then we have partners at Argonne National Lab, at the National Renewable Energy Lab, and at the University of Tennessee. And we're a mixture of biologists, chemists, and chemical engineers. So if we weren't bound in to fermentation, what would we like our conversion process of biomass to fuels to look like? What would be the desired characteristics? We don't want to have to care what biomass crop turns up at the biorefinery door. I don't want to care whether it's poplar tree or a eucalyptus tree, or whether it's a maize stover or it's some other form of plant material. We want to maximize the carbon and energy efficiency. We want to recover these desired co-product streams. All right. Now, the reason that's important is that if you think of fuel, it's very high volume, but it's relatively low value. Okay, so what are we paying at the gas pumps? We're paying about $2.50, $3 at the moment. That's not a lot for a gallon of gas. To make the economics of fuel work, the petrochemical industry takes advantage of all the other products that we make from oil. And so we want to have substitutes for those products as well as for the fuel. And then also, we would like our conversion process to be scalable. We don't want to be locked in to having $400 million biorefineries being built to service a biofuels industry. We want to be able to scale that so that it's a much more distributed system, where you might even have some kind of mobile biorefinery that drives to the farm and adds value to the biomass on site, and then takes it to a biorefinery. So, what are the options other than fermentation? We've talked about sugars and the ethanol industry going through fermentation. There are a couple of other existing options. There's the syngas option. So the Shell refinery in South Africa can take biomass, can gasify it, so extremely high temperatures, fragment it just into very, very small molecules, allow those to condense back down and form alkanes by Fischer-Tropsch chemistry. Essentially, break every single molecular bond that you can and then allow them to recombine. People are thinking of pyrolysis as an option, not as high a temperature as would gasify the material, but maybe melt it maybe melt these biomass molecules into a biocrude oil that you could then take to a refinery and use catalysts to upgrade. Our focus is on catalytic conversion. So the catalysts that were in the original scenario were biological enzymes. But enzymes are fragile. They're easily broken, they're difficult to recover. When we talk about catalysts in this context, we're thinking of chemicals. We're thinking robust, inorganic, preferably cheap chemicals that can be used over and over again to take biomass molecules and convert them, transform them directly into fuel molecules and into these high-value organics. The model here is the sort of the petrochemical industry that provides us with fuel, but it also provides us with a variety of interesting materials, so solvents and plastics and paints and adhesives and so forth, and fertilizer actually for crops that all depend on having a supply of oil. So these are the chemicals that are used as the starting blocks in the petrochemical industry. So polyethylenes from ethylene, for example, polypropylene from propylene is a starting block. All of these are currently derived from oil. So do we have any indication that we could do this? This is work from Mahdi Abu Omar's group in chemistry. It's a reaction he calls a DARE reaction, diol to alkene. And it's a catalyst that's a methyl trioxyrrhenium catalyst. And at relatively low pressures of hydrogen and at relatively low temperatures, 150 degrees, it can take a structure with two hydroxyls on it and convert that structure to one with a double bond, a carbon double bond, with very good recovery, 90 to 95%. So sugars are structures that when they're not in their ring form, when they're in their open chain form, have those diols accessible for this reaction. What he's able to show is that he can get to the hexene. So he can get the alkene, which is actually maybe a useful starting block for the chemical industry. And then with a little more hydrogen, of course, you can hydrogenate that to a short chain alkane. And then there's another chemical reaction that will take these short chain alkanes and stitch them together into the longer chain alkanes that we would think of as being typical components of gasoline. So we think this is one example of the kind of catalytic chemistry that we're thinking of. And we want to understand a lot more about how this particular catalyst is working. And rhenium is not that expensive, but it's not cheap, to see if we could design some other catalysts that would carry out these reactions, but really be very cheap and able to regenerate. So the other value in thinking of this as a problem of chemical transformation rather than as a problem of biological fermentation is that we think we might be able to use the lignin, which is otherwise lost to us as a form of carbon. And the interesting thing about lignin, this is the what we think the structure is shown here, is that you'll notice a lot of aromatic rings in this structure. And they're joined together by all these ether bonds that are very difficult to break. But if we think again of the composition of gasoline, 3/4 alkanes, 1/4 aromatic components, aromatic ring structures. We think if we could actually fragment this lignin macromolecule into smaller pieces, but keep the ring structures intact, we would be able to mix the products from the breakdown of the lignin with the products from our sugar chemistry and get something that is gasoline-like. Okay? So the idea here being that make a drop-in biofuel that resembles closely what you already have as an existing fuel, and that way you don't have to change your engine to accommodate some new fuel. You don't have to change all of the infrastructure that goes with delivering fuels. So the chemical engineers, that's the chemists, the chemical engineers are looking at a process they call fast hydropyrolysis and hydrodeoxygenation. And the idea with this is that it is pyrolysis, but it's pyrolysis heating to very high temperatures for very short spans of time in the presence of hydrogen. So they're currently doing this out at the Zucro labs, where if things go wrong and the hydrogen explodes, it'll be less catastrophic for the main campus. Okay, so the hydrogen is very important to us. And actually, we dodged the question about hydrogen when we put in this grant proposal. We fudged it and we said, hey, some other energy frontier research center is going to take care of the problem of how to generate hydrogen for us in a carbon neutral way. So we don't improve our carbon efficiency if that hydrogen comes from coal, right? If it's made as a product of having burnt coal. We do improve our carbon efficiency if we can generate hydrogen from solar or wind or nuclear energy, right? If we use that as our energy input to make hydrogen in some process. So we need a carbon-free energy source that will help us to make hydrogen. That hydrogen is essential because the biomass is very rich in oxygen. All those oxygen atoms in the sugars and in the aromatic rings of the lignin component, those make that material not very energy dense. So if we can hydrogenate it, we increase the energy density of the material. They also want to, as well as having heat in this process, they want to throw in some catalysts. We're calling them bomb-proof catalysts because they're going to have to withstand these high temperatures. They're going to have to withstand the presence of the hydrogen. And we hope that these bomb-proof catalysts will actually change the spectrum of the reaction products that come out of this process. So again, we're heading towards something that's like a bio-crude oil, but maybe directing it towards more specific sets of products than you currently get in oil. One of their favorite cheap catalysts is iron and actually other transition metals. And I want to come back to that at the end. But the presence of iron in this kind of scheme might do a couple of different things for us. It might act catalytically to change the product, but it might also provide really local heating sources for breaking molecular bonds. So it might change the amount of energy that is needed to be put in to melt the biomass in the first place, right? So and I just tell you that because I want to come back to what we're doing as biologists to help out the chemical engineers with this scheme. We really need to provide a new kind of scientific understanding of how these catalysts are acting on the biomass molecules. So a lot of our center is focused on developing tools and techniques that allow us to image biomass molecules and then image those biomass molecules in combination with catalysts that we might add or mix in. So one example is shown here where because the chemical engineers like transition metal catalysts, it'd be good if we could actually image where those transition metals go. And here we can see the location of copper and zinc as color images, but shown from X-ray fluorescence imaging. Atomic force microscopy with our colleagues at the National Renewable Energy Lab is giving us new depth of understanding of even how the biomass is constructed. So the top image here is similar to the one I showed you before, showing the architecture of the wall, but this time by an atomic force micrograph. And you can see, again, the scaffolding poles, the cellulose microfibrils, and you can see the polysaccharides that link between them, indicated with the green arrows. But atomic force microscopy allows us to go in really close, and we think in this lower image, we're looking at the individual glucose residues in the cellulose chains that are bound together to form that scaffolding structure. So we're really beginning to see even just single glucose units. And this allows us to do the computational modeling. So this is now what we think that the cellulose microfibril structure is like. And those green spheres are supposed to represent maybe some iron ions that are coming in and going to do some kind of reaction with the cellulose structure. Hilke Kentema in the chemistry department is building the world's biggest, best, most sensitive, highest resolution mass spectrometer ever since the world began. So she is taking she's going to patent this, and we're going to license it back to Thermo because they will then sell it other places, and hopefully we'll get some revenue back to the grant from this. But she is doing this because when you look at a mass spectrum of for example, lignin that's been purified from oak trees, it's an incredibly complex mixture of components. I mean, it's really, you can't see the individual molecular structures here. But after a treatment with a catalyst, we actually reduce that complexity a great deal. But we need these instruments in order to be able to see those changes and to see what the major species are that are being produced. So I'm a biologist, I'm a plant biologist, and so what I like to think about in this center is how can I, as a plant biologist, alter the composition of the biomass so that it's really tailored, it's really prepared for degradation by some of these chemical and thermal processes that the chemists and the chemical engineers are developing. So this is one strategy that we're taking, just as an example of that, of how we tailor biomass for its end use, using the tools and tricks of plant molecular biology and genetic engineering. This is now a transmission electron micrograph. It's a very thin slice through a portion of a cell, and everything from about the middle of the slide down to the bottom of the slide is what the cell wall looks like just prepared under conventional TEM conditions. And in the blue, there's a lump of iron metal catalyst. And in the yellow, what you're looking at is the cell wall, that biomass, becoming defibrillated. It's sort of separating out. Where the catalyst is touching the cell wall polymers, it's having some action at loosening up that structure. And you can see that the whole problem here is that the point, the surface area of contact between the catalyst and the biomass is very small. So we started thinking, well, how could we improve that? How could we improve the interaction of the catalyst with the biomass? So we know proteins that will bind iron. And we also know proteins that will bind to cellulose microfibrils. So what we thought was, suppose we could engineer these plants so that they were expressing a protein that would get out into that cell wall space, bind to a microfibril, and have one of these iron binding domains attached to it. And then effectively what we would be doing is delivering those iron ions right through the structure of the biomass as the plant is growing. So this is our scheme. This is we're 1 year into this project, which is why I'm not showing you a huge amount of data. But one strategy, for example, is that here's the cellulose microfibril shown at the bottom. We express the cellulose binding domain. We couple it with the metal binding domain, and that delivers our catalyst for us. And it sits there waiting for that hydropyrolytic conversion. So it's like a Trojan horse catalyst sitting in the biomass. We know we can get the cellulose binding domain to work because we can take a single microfibril and we can use that CBM and we can couple it to a quantum dot so that each of those white spheres that you're seeing in that top image are showing the location of one of those CBMs stuck on a single cellulose microfibril. We also know we can get the CBM outside into the cell wall. So if we couple it to a fluorescent protein, we get the fluorescence out in the cell wall space. So what we're working on now is actually replacing that fluorescent protein with the metal binding peptide. And then we're going to demonstrate delivery of that metal to the wall. So this is what we think. If we do this, if we can take these biomass molecules and we can do the science and the engineering to transform them into fuel molecules and really understand at the molecular level what's going on, then this is the impact in the long term. This is what we're thinking of as being our social impact 5 or 10 years out from now, from building that knowledge base. We think that we can more than double capture carbons into fuel compared with this biological scenario of using enzymes. We think that we could expand the product range. We think that we could get to the alkanes and the aromatics typical of gasoline rather than focusing on ethanol. It would allow us to keep all of the current liquid fuel infrastructure because we would have a drop-in fuel rather than having to convert with the problems of piping ethanol. It would enable a new kind of agro industry, which would be these tailored, engineered energy crops that are maximally prepared to be deconstructed. And it would minimize the land area that we would need to grow the biomass on. So double the carbon efficiency, half the amount of land. We're still not going to get a biofuels industry out of that. We're still going to need to increase the yield per acre, but this will be a good contribution to that. So this is our C3 Bio team. This is our all-hands retreat, which the postdocs and the students came to. So we've 16 graduate students, 10 postdocs working on this project, and 4 technicians. and Carl, our managing director, and one admin assistant who keeps us all on track. So thanks for your attention, and I'm happy to take any questions. A metal binding protein. So we know we can engineer a plant that will make, that will deliver a fluorescent protein out to the cell wall and bind that protein to the cellulose microfibril. But what we then want to do is replace that protein with a metal binding protein so that we're now delivering our catalyst there. And I'll tell you that ideally, it's not the cellulose that we want to go after. This is just a proof of concept experiment. What I would really like us to be able to do is target the lignin. I want a protein that will bind to some of the structures in lignin and deliver a catalyst there.
Suppose you make it up to 80% conversion efficiency. I always hear that biomass requires a lot of land. How much land would we require at 80% efficiency?
Oh, okay. This is a good question. So, I need to give you it in a sense of scale. So, Texas and probably Florida. All right, so it's still a lot of land, but if you look at the production of ethanol, where we are at the moment with ethanol production, we would need about 1/3 of the land mass in the U.S. just to displace about half of the fuel needs. Okay, so if we can get it down to just being Texas and Florida, right, that will actually be tremendous. It's still a huge amount of biomass. Because you look at our current agricultural system, it produces 1 billion tons of food and feed. So if you add up all of the fruits, the vegetables, the grains, pasture, hay, that's a billion tons of biomass that our current agricultural system produces. We would need close to the same amount of biomass. We would need a second agricultural system equivalent in size to what we have now for food and feed production. So that's why the conversion efficiency is so important, because that would take it down to half of that.
But by increasing, like getting an extra billion of food and feed that you need, is that necessarily going to compete with our food supply and that growth, or?
Well, we hope not. This is a huge issue, is, you know, how you use the existing land. So some of the crops that are being thought of as bioenergy crops, people are thinking of them that they would not be used on prime agricultural land, right? So you'll hear about switchgrass and miscanthus as being sort of prairie grasses, where you could grow them away from farmland, essentially. Again, fast-growing trees are not going to compete with the food supply if you're still growing them on the land that you normally grow trees on, right? Now, having said that, where does the water fall? The water is really important in terms of actual plant yield. So from my perspective, right, a biofuels industry can start in the Midwest because this is the best land. This is where the water is falling. This is where farmers are going to start being able to grow this stuff, harvest it, and deliver it. So I think it's a little disingenuous, actually, to say that, oh, well, we'll take over all these other areas of land that we don't currently use for food and feed production. I think what we really have to think about is how you can incorporate a bioenergy crop into a normal cycle that a farmer would have. So, for example, right? If the farmer can grow an annual crop, like sweet sorghum, or a maize plant that is 20 feet high 1 year, right? Maybe the next year he can choose to grow maize for grain, or he can choose to grow soybean, or some other food crop, right? He's not locked in to a particular grass species. So Miscanthus, for example, will take 3 years to establish in a field, and then you can't do anything else with that field. So the sort of the agriculture, the agronomics of how these bioenergy crops get implemented, that is a huge deal, right? And I think it's almost inevitably going to have some impact on food and feed. It's how you devise the logistics of making sure that effect is minimized.
I have a question. So you said you need hydrogen for some of the conversions that you're going to use.
Yes.
So how does that compare, the amount of how much hydrogen do you need, and how does that compare with just using hydrogen as an alternative fuel?
Yeah, this is a very good question. So I don't have numbers for you on this, because our systems engineer, Rakesh Agrawal, is thinking all the time about how to minimize the amount of hydrogen that we would need and balance it with perhaps, say, a little increase in heat. Okay. So, yeah, I don't have a good answer for you in terms of quantity, because they're still building the reactor. So
the process where you were explaining how they convert sugar into it's like a gasoline-like form by breaking the chains and could you like briefly explain it again?
So it's a chemical reaction called the Barton-McCombie reaction, and it takes two short chain alkanes and makes a covalent link between them that will give you a C12. Okay, so you take two C6s and make a C12 alkane, or take two C5s and make a C10 alkane.
Doctor, what's this reactor you're building? Is it here in Purdue?
Yes. Yeah, no, so they have several different reactors going. So they have the one out at Zucro we're calling the rocket reactor, because of the hydrogen. And there's also a sort of lab scale version of it that they're building over in chemical engineering that actually took a lot longer to develop than we thought it would. It took about 6 months because they had to think of the safety of using hydrogen in that building. So it's smaller scale, and we think if it blows up, it won't cause too much damage. But yeah. And then they have other sort of flatbed reactors. So, and I think there's currently four different reactor systems that are being tested out.
Because the crops are seasonal, like how would that affect productivity throughout the year, like as far as reason?
Yeah, so one thing you want to be able to do is you want to be able to store the biomass and then use it on a continual basis, right? So biomass, when it's stored, it doesn't easily degrade, right? So I can imagine that you know the kind of silo system that you see for grain storage? That you could have an equivalent system where there would be, you know, large barns spaced at about 6 to 10 mile intervals along a rail track where you would store the biomass. Okay. And that the processes that we're thinking of and the importance of scalability is that maybe that sort of co-op level, so a few farms contributing to a centralized silo that's already serviced by rail track, would give you the appropriate scale to start with. So you could plant your biorefinery at that sort of siloed site, have your biomass delivered there. It's not traveling a huge distance, and that's where you add value to it by some kind of processing.
Just and further point, as far as
if you have your farmers like using a three crop system or something like that,
yeah.
And you need your farmers to be in a local region, doesn't that affect the biorefinery's ability to sustain productivity throughout the farmers?
Well, that's right. But you see, you know, the farmers have got to make a living. And one of the pieces that's kind of missing at the moment is, how are you going to guarantee them a price for their crop when there's no biorefinery to sell it to, right? So you need these pieces, you need this $400 million investment, and then you've got to have this guaranteed supply of biomass, but the farmer isn't going to want to be locked in to a price, you know, that will cover decades to supply this biorefinery. So I don't think that scenario is actually workable. And that's why I'm very keen on this idea of sort of distributed, scalable projects, where if it's in the farmer's interests and they'll get the best price for growing a bioenergy crop that year, they can do it, right? Or they can choose to do something else. And then the onus is on the biorefinery to actually give a good price.
If there are no more questions,
is there 1 billion tons a year of biomass that is used for food or...
Yeah, so food or feed.
Feed.
Yeah.
How much of that is actually consumed, and how much is waste that would be laying on the fields again? Is it 100% consumed, 100% used for food and feed?
Well, so that number is actual consumption.
Wow.
Number.
So the rest
yeah.
of it is laying on the fields?
Yes, yes. So it's important that some of it does lie on the field, because you want to recover some of that carbon back into the soil and keep your soil carbon going, right? So you can't take everything. But yeah, it's a huge number.
Do you know how long, you said you're working on 4 reactors, and I guess you're working on all these different things.
Yes.
I guess when the reactors will be done, we'll start doing these tests.
Yes.
What's your timeline for that?
Oh, yes. Well, this is an excellent question. So my timeline is dominated by the Department of Energy, actually, because they're going to come and review us in probably a year and a half from now. So we want to have something to show them, because we hope that they'll give us another slug of money and keep these EFRCs running. So we're hoping still to be in business in 10, 15 years' time. So,
any more questions?
Here, let's thank Dr. McCann for.